This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. In a few weeks, Mike Chitwood pins on the Volusia County Sheriff's badge. Chitwood's been an outspoken police chief in Daytona Beach, and now with a much bigger jurisdiction to oversee, he says there's only one way to get a feel for the job.
Well, the first thing we're going to do is on January 1st at 12:01 when I take office, I'll be out in patrol in the county's largest city of Daytona. So I'm going to spend my first day, first midnight shift actually, working out there on the street with the deputy side by side with him. And then a little later on that morning, I've summoned the command staff on January 1st to a mandatory meeting for all the captains and above where I'm going to outline my agenda.
If going out on patrol is Chitwood's strategy to win the trust of his deputies, he says he's also committed to getting buy-in from the citizens of Volusia County.
It all starts with listening with the community, a pledge to diversity. You know, we speak 14 different languages in Volusia County alone. It is important that any organization reflects the community that it serves. But also, in diversity, you also get better service because you push paradigms. If everybody is raised in the same high school, the same grade school, in the same neighborhood, they all think the same. But when you hire people with different backgrounds, with different ethnicity, you get a much broader way of solving a problem.
It's going to be tough, though, to hire deputies who can speak all of those 14 languages, right, across your force?
That is true. But, you know, predominantly we'll be looking for Hispanic is definitely a growing number in our community, and that's where we're going to be targeting, you know, African-Americans. We lack sorely in African-American involvement in our agency. Those are the main targets of which we're going to push forward on. And technology. Technology is huge, and we need to leverage it to go after criminals, stop problems before they begin. And technology also keeps the community safer. The more information that I can get in the hands of deputies and they're responding to calls, the less likely they are to make a bad decision, the less likely they are to have provide a bad level of service. And the more educated they are, the less likely are they use deadly force. And that's what we're talking about there.
You seem like you're quite keen on the sort of boots on the ground, old school policing, though. So do you think some sheriff's departments get a little too tied up in the technology and don't spend enough time kind of out walking the beat?
I think that's what's happened to us in American policing altogether. As more and more technology has emerged, it has isolated us from our community. And sometimes it's really hard. I mean, when you look at a patrol car today, there isn't much you can't do from your patrol car. Whether it's your onboard computer, you can do fingerprints, you can have portable tag readers, every database imaginable is there, the radio's gone, your cell phone's gone. There is so much information there that we all seem sometimes to get away from the number one tenet of policing, and that is the boots on the ground. The detectives were called gumshoes for a reason, because they were out walking around, the beat cop. You know, that was a big thing when I grew up. School resource officers, there were cops all over the place, on foot and on horseback. And now it seems we get in that car, you put those windows up, you turn that air on, and you're just running job to job, and the people just see you driving through the street, not so much as part of the community, more sometimes of an occupying force.
Talk to me about school resource officers then, because some counties, you know, like Orange County, for example, they have officers specifically trained for that job.
We're in the schools now. We're not in as many schools as we could be. There's over 65 schools, I believe, in Volusia County. What we did in Daytona Beach was we were very fortunate. We wrote a grant that geared towards school resource officers, and I was able to put 10 school resource officers in all 10 Daytona Beach schools, elementary, middle, and high school. And the positive effects are just unbelievable. Not only are the officers there for safety and security purposes, but after school they become part of the social fabric of the school. One of my deputies is the strength and flexibility coach at Mainland High School. So when school's over, they see him in gym shorts. He's the strength and flexibility coach. We have another young lady who was a school teacher. She runs the homework club. So when school's over, she's running the homework club. So that's the benefit of having school resource officers. And we're going to try to find the funding to get as many deputies as we can into schools because it's a positive influence. You know, an anecdotal story, one of the things that's pretty sad for me is I'll go to an elementary school and read to the kids and ask how many want to be police officers when they grow up. In the 20 kids in the room, 18 will put their hand up and say they want to. I'll go to middle school and 20 kids and maybe two will put their hands up. I go to high school and you're completely turned off.
But isn't that partly because as you know, they get older and they learn a bit more about what it might mean to be a police officer, they realize it's a tough job, and whether you're a police officer, whether you're a sheriff's deputy?
I think when you get a little older, I think you look and see things, you get a little more skeptical. But if you had a positive influence in your life, if you had a positive interaction as a young person with an officer, that carries through in my heart, that's what I believe. You know, when I grew up, I was a PAL kid, even though I was a second-generation cop. But the police department for me was my father on one side, but the officer that ran our PAL program, he really wasn't an officer. He was your coach. He was your mentor. He got you extra tutoring help. And that PAL program carried me from when I was 7 to when I was 17, basketball, baseball, football, and boxing. So that played a huge influence in shaping me and my friends as we grew up.
What is the PAL program?
Police Athletic League. We have one in Daytona Beach that we're going to emulate here in the county. It's not so much geared towards sports as it's geared toward reading and education. An overwhelming majority of kids in Daytona Beach, and approximately 60% of our kids in the 32114 zip code live at or below the poverty level. While that's not an indicator that you're going to have a life of crime, it's certainly an obstacle that those kids have to overcome. And we discover when we start arresting them that they can't read or they're reading at a kindergarten level and they're in, you know, 7th and 8th and freshman in high school. So our PAL program, with the help of the courts, the kids get sentenced to us and they have to go through a program. And 68% of those kids do not reoffend and their marks go up in that 6 months that they're sentenced to us, for lack of a better term.
And when you say sentencing, I mean, is it a criminal record or does it get expunged if they go through this program?
The judge will sentence them as part of their probation, depending on how the severity of their crime, to get your marks together, you know, stop being truant. You know, it's part of our ankle monitoring program as well. There's an ankle monitor program that goes on some of these kids. This way they don't go to secure facility. It's that last-ditch effort for them to try to improve their behavior. And with that, there's a case study done of the family and the child, because a child doesn't learn to be truant. It isn't born to be truant. It's a loud behavior from the families. So we try to break truancy. We look for drug and alcohol problems. We look for anger management issues. We look for education issues. And we try to bring as much of the social services component to these young people as humanly possible. And at the end of the program, like I said, 68% of these kids don't reoffend. 68% of these kids, their marks improve dramatically while they're in this program.
Now, you mentioned backup for officers. Just give me a little more detail on what that means for the folks who are out on patrol.
What I talked about is one of the things that I'm learning in my interviews with the deputies is they feel there's a disconnect between administration and the deputies that are out on the street answering calls. To lead effectively in my style of leadership and the offense that I run, I expect to see upper management, my chief deputy, the majors, and the captains out on the street backing up their officers, because you earn the respect and admiration of your officers when you do it. When we go to implement change, if the officers see the leadership actively following that change, it's more than an order or a directive. They know it's the way the department is going to breathe. It's going to function this way. And that's what I want my majors and my captains to do. Do we have other obligations once you hit upper management? Absolutely. You absolutely do. But you have to carve time out, whether it's on a Saturday or a Sunday or a Friday night, to get out there and tell the troops, I'm not here to catch you doing something bad. I'm out here to catch you doing something right so I can tell you that you're doing a great job.
So like you, pretty much everybody who has a job which is predominantly behind a desk and doing that kind of thing, that you want to see them out on patrol from time to time?
As me and the chief deputy form our management team, they are the qualities that we will be looking for. We're looking for folks who are obviously smart and know the inside and outs of the organization, but we want people who are not afraid to go down to the level of deputy and do what they did when they were first hired. Answer radio calls, provide service to the community, back one another up. That's what we want.
You talked about the number of times that the deputies in November have been fired upon, and I think it was two instances. Is this job getting more dangerous?
It clearly is. I've been a cop for almost 29 years. I have never witnessed anything in my 29-year career that I have seen that has transpired in the last 18 months. You know, officer in a coffee shop in Washington gets gunned down. Officer sitting in his parked car, gunned down. Dallas, officers gunned down for no apparent reason. And people that are doing it are doing it knowing they're going to die in an ensuing firefight. They're willing to give their life to do this. So there's a fanaticism there that I know I haven't seen in my career. And that is scary. And it is a scary thing. And yet I'm asking these officers to go out at night, provide a service, you know, be mindful of the community, follow all the laws, knowing that the next time they turn or shut their car off, somebody could be waiting to kill them.
And that kind of comes back to something else you're talking about too, which is pay, right? So put that in perspective. Are your deputies getting paid enough? And if not, are you going to try and bump that pay up?
I don't have the power myself as the sheriff under our county charter to give pay raises, but I do have the power to advocate the other elected officials. I have the power to advocate to our community that we need to take a look at this issue. It's an issue. I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of deputies. Every single one of them come in, and the number one thing they talk about is pay and pay compression. They're not asking to be the highest paid sheriff's office in the state. All they're asking for is some parity. And right now, you start animal control, and if you're a code enforcement officer, you make more money than a deputy makes in starting hourly salary. Something is grossly wrong with that. Animal control folks, they do a great job. Code enforcement, they do a great job. They work for me in Daytona. But you go through hundreds, thousands of hours of training to become a deputy. You put your life on the line. You work nights, weekends, and holidays. Let's take a look at how the pay scale is, and let's give them some parity here.
Governor Rick Scott has called for a 5% pay boost for Florida Highway Patrol. So will that give you some heart that things might change at the county level too for sheriff's offices, whether it's yours or others?
I hope it will. I can tell you that the governor has been a great friend to law enforcement. When our police car was torched in Daytona Beach, the governor called me personally to make sure no officer was hurt and to make sure that we had everything humanly possible to do our job. When Hurricane Matthew was bearing down on us, he called me again from his personal cell phone and said, "Chief, what do you need in Daytona Beach? What do you and your officers need to keep that community safe?" So I think with support like that, it's going to be kind of hard for the council not to say we need to take a look at pay, starting pay and pay for the deputies.
Let me ask too about the size of this group of folks you're in charge of compared to your time as police chief in Daytona Beach.
Well, my budget in Daytona was around $35 million. The budget here for the sheriff's office is $88 million. In Daytona, I had 240 sworn officers and probably 100 support. Here, I have 450 sworn and another 400-plus support. So it's roughly twice, 2.5 times the size of what it was in Daytona Beach.
Is that enough? Do you want more deputies?
I think that that's something we have to look at. As I take office with the chief deputy, there are things we have to say. The way we did business in the past, we can't afford to do that anymore. And like I said earlier, the population of Volusia County since 2000 has increased by 80,000. We have not in the Volusia County Sheriff's Office increased our size. That's something we need to look at. That's something we absolutely have to look at.
Are you a little bit nervous about this? I mean, you mentioned being excited about the job, but do you have some trepidation as January 1st grows closer?
I had a bunch of trepidation on election night, kind of like the movie The Candidate. When Robert Redford wins, he turns to his campaign manager and says, "What do I do now?" And that's kind of what happened on the night of the election when I won. I turned to my campaign manager and said, "What do I do now?" But obviously, as the time has gone on and I'm meeting with these focus groups, I'm meeting with church leaders, I'm meeting with my deputies, you know, homicide victims that aren't even related to me, that we're not even investigating, are coming in to talk to me about what they feel of the pace of the investigation. It has basically opened up that, like I'm a little kid at Christmas, there's a great challenge awaiting us ahead. You know, my hardest decision so far has been finding the right fit for us as chief deputy in John Creamer. I got that. I got a great partner, and I just cannot wait for January 1st. We have lists of things that we want to do. A lot of the changes that we're going to make aren't going to cost a dime. We're just going to try to roll out modern policing techniques and good old-fashioned police work and community relations to move us forward.
I understand you're a cycling buff. You're going to have time for that in your new job?
I will make sure, and I pledged this when I ran, every Friday, myself and my command staff are going to ride through a different city. Deltona, for example, the mayor is excited. He can't wait to get out on a bike because he wants me to bike through his community so he could point out different things that I need to know. It's a great way to get to know the community. When I was chief in Daytona, the command staff went out every single Friday, and they were only instructed to bring a legal pad and a group of business cards with them. So when people talk to us, you can give their card, take down their complaint, and get back to them with the results. And it was a huge success, and we're going to do that here.
Are you going to miss your old job in Daytona Beach?
I will always miss being the police chief in Daytona Beach. It was, you know, my first 18 years were spent with the Philadelphia Police Department. And when I left Philadelphia to become a chief in Oklahoma, I thought nothing will ever compare to being at home. I landed in Daytona Beach. I fell in love professionally and personally with the place. I love this county. Daytona Beach holds a huge, huge place in my heart. And, I have fond memories of those folks. And I think in the role I'm in now, I'll be able to do even more to help municipal law enforcement.
Sheriff-elect Mike Chitwood, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Still to come, Kidstown is the first part of a multi-million dollar makeover plan for the Orlando Science Center. Sure, it looks like a giant playground, but the aim is really to get kids hooked on science early. Intersection continues in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Stealth learning is how Orlando Science Centre President Joanne Newman describes what goes on at Kidstown. It's the Science Centre's revamped exhibit for toddlers to seven-year-olds. It might look like a giant adventure playground, but there's a serious mission behind it, getting young minds hooked on science. I visited the Science Centre and talked to Newman and the VP of Education, Heather Norton.
Joanne Newman, tell me about this new Kidstown exhibit we're looking at. I read it was about $5 million worth of work.
Absolutely. This has been several years in the making, and it's all about trying to teach the correct skills. Like, developmentally, it's geared toward children ages 7 and younger, and each area has a set of activities that promote different kinds of STEM-type skills. There's, you know, critical thinking, problem-solving, cause and effect, those kinds of things that are really helping our children grow and learn. And one of our philosophies is you can't start early enough with our children in terms of exposing them to these kinds of activities.
What we're standing looking at right now, explain what that is. It looks like a kind of a ginormous jungle gym.
Yeah, that's the climber. And that's all about a little bit of challenging the risk-taking aspect of children. Some people have a little bit of a fear of heights, so you can climb into this. There are all kinds of interactives within the climber that are very cool. There's a sloth hang where you can hang on to a rope and time yourself. And then when you come down the climber, you can see what your heart rate is. So it kind of combines both a little bit of that mental challenge of the risk-taking as well as the physical activity that is so important for our young children.
So you're trying to put a bit of physical fitness in there as well.
Absolutely. And then the understanding of your body, how that affects your heart rate, etc.
What are kids gravitating towards? Because the old Kidstown, it was all about the orange grove and pretending to pick oranges and process them and stuff. Is that still there?
Oh, yes. So over there, that's the Orange Grove presented by the Dr. Phillips Foundation. And that is one of the very popular areas. But actually, as we've asked our guests who've come, because Kidstown's only been open since the end of October, and said, what is your favorite part of it? We're getting everything, because there's so much that you can do. There's the Orange Grove, there's the climber, there's an amazing water play area over here. There's also air play, sort of construction and building, and there are special areas designated for the youngest children, 0 to 2, which we've never had before.
And I guess when you started Kidstown back in the day, the citrus industry was still a pretty big part of the Central Florida economy, right? Things have changed a bit since then, but the Orange Grove is still a kind of legacy of that?
Absolutely. And so we're able to add in a little bit of the history of what our area was built upon. So we love telling a little bit of the story of the Orange Grove.
Well, let me bring you in this conversation, Heather Norton. You actually have a school here. Tell me what goes on at that school.
Sure. So we have a fully licensed preschool that takes place here in the Science Center. It's actually in its 7th year of operation, and we have 70 young children who come to school here between 3 and 4 years old. So they spend their earliest years with us, and we are able to not only teach all the early childhood domains that are important to young learners, but really do a focus on STEM learning at that youngest level. So it's been a really exciting endeavor for the Science Center to be able to explore what you can do with children in that age before they go on to their K-12 education.
Is it part of the Orange County public school system?
No, this is a private school. It's owned and operated by the Science Center. And this is something that we're seeing actually nationally throughout science centers and museums, is starting to explore what we can do by hosting a school or running a school within our institutions.
There is a big focus on STEM education now. The kids who are at your school, though, do you track where they end up after they graduate?
So it's a little difficult to follow children across their K-12 education for a variety of reasons. But one thing we've really tried to do is keep our families close and engaged to the Science Center throughout their child's life. So having them come back and do things like summer camps and field trip programs and competitions. So through that engagement, we're able to figure out where they're going and learn more about them than we would otherwise. One of the things that we're looking at, though, is we have really strong relationships with the local school districts. And through those relationships, we're constantly talking about how we can look for measurable impacts with our children. in a variety of contexts, not only our school children, but the programs that children come and participate in as well. So it's something that we're continuing to pursue, absolutely.
So what is a measure of success when you look at a kid going through this preschool? What do you want to see as, say, we've done a great job here with this kid?
So one of the really exciting things about working with these young children is we're able to see them grow exponentially year after year. And we measure success as if their confidence is increased, if they see themselves as scientists or engineers, even on a rudimentary level, if they're using vocabulary or unafraid of tools and experiences that are surrounded in strong science and STEM areas. Those are all measures of success for us. One of the things we're seeing is we lose our children earlier and earlier in their interest in science and STEM. And so if we give our children a really strong starting point where they feel confident and it's something they're already used to, how much better is it for them when they go into K-12 and are then faced with all the other things that are going to be tasked to them during that time?
What about the parents then? Are parents who send their kids to this school, are they interested in science, or is it something where it might be from a family who has no background in science and you're able to reach that and kind of create that first generation of somebody who's got an interest in this field?
Sure. So I think all parents want to give their children the best things that they can. You know, they want them to have good educations. They want them to have the best that life can provide. Our families, I think, do believe that science is important, and they do come to us because we have a really strong, high-quality program that does infuse science learning into a preschool environment. However, not all of our families are scientists or come from a really strong science background themselves. I think they see the value of what a museum school can provide, and they know that that's something that will benefit their child. So I think we convert some to being stronger proponents of science, but I'd say we probably have a healthy mix of different backgrounds and families that come to us.
And then they get recess?
Of course they get recess. So
are they playing around here during recess?
They do get to play here. So because we're a fully licensed school, we do have to focus on the whole child, so including imaginative play and outdoor time. And so we have a playground that the children do go onto every day. And then they also get the benefit of all of our exhibitry here at the museum. So our teachers are able to incorporate different exhibits or different areas into what they're learning, as well as just letting them have free exploration time or time to really enjoy what the museum has.
Joanne, let me bring you back on the conversation. I want to ask sort of about the big picture, because you know, a lot of the community leaders here have been pushing this idea of Central Florida, Orlando, being a focal point for this kind of career, like a STEM career. But I'm wondering what your sense is of whether kids who go through a STEM education, go on to college, get a science degree, are there the kind of jobs in Central Florida that they can make a good career if they stick around?
Oh, yeah. I think it's really, we are growing that side of Central Florida. We are a tech hub. There's a lot of modeling, simulation, and training. So that sector is growing very quickly. The fear is that we don't have the talent pool here locally to fill those jobs. And so our viewpoint from the Science Center standpoint, we want to begin to expose our children to these different kinds of careers and these different opportunities. We've learned two things, Matthew. One is you can't start early enough. You have to start them really young to overcome some of those fears and to make sure that that they're really ready to move on to the next levels, as Heather was saying. The other thing we see is there still is a lot of underrepresentation. Students of color and girls in certain of these tech fields, or we're still very much underperforming in that way. So in order to fill the jobs, we've got to be able to reach more broadly throughout the community. And there are a number of initiatives that we've taken on here at the Science Center to do just that. And this is a great place where kids aren't afraid of science when they're in the Science Center. They're having so much fun and they're engaging, but in all the while they are learning and they're starting to be exposed to all these different, not only the careers, but the skills, the important skill sets that they would need to be successful in those careers.
So there's a bit of a demographic challenge in getting more folks involved in STEM. What about economically? Is there a barrier there, people from lower socioeconomic groups getting involved in science careers?
Absolutely. I think it comes down more to role models. So we see a lot of kids and children out there who, if their parent isn't an engineer or they're not really exposed to what some of the careers are, if they don't know what an engineer is, then they don't have a chance of becoming one. And when they come to the Science Center, we have an exhibit hall called Engineer It. We talk about that process, the engineering design process. And so kids become familiar with those terms, and our goal is to inspire them, to excite them, and then help point them in the right direction where they can go learn more. I mean, the Science Center plays one critical part in this, but it takes everyone in the community. And we have a lot of great partners who are helping us get kids all the way through this journey.
Now, looking around this new exhibit, it's bigger, right? You're taking up more floor space. It's a little more bright and bold, and there's more things going on. I'm wondering, in Central Florida specifically, because we have the theme parks on our doorstep, do you have to make your science center that more engaging because kids here are more used to that level of performance when it comes to an exhibit like this?
Absolutely. We know that we have the greatest theme parks in the world here at our doorstep, and they set a very high bar for quality. And that's something that I think everybody in Central Florida needs to understand. We certainly do here at the Science Center. And a part of the changes that we've made along our, let's say, these last 7 years, they've all been about customer service and quality and making sure we can't be all things to all people, but if we are going to do it and tackle a problem, then we're going to do it really well. It's going to be a strong offering. It's going to be very high quality. And I think our community has come to demand that basically because they're so used to getting it in all the offerings that you can get right here on our doorstep.
There's an entertainment value to what you have here as well as the science, right? Is part of what you're doing just kind of sneaking the science in there wrapped up in this entertainment package?
Yes, we call it stealth learning sometimes, but it is. I think the children and the families want to come and have fun. Science can be a very daunting subject and a scary subject for a lot of people. First of all, we want to get you in. We want you to be having fun. And then, but what differentiates us truly is that we've designed these experiences for the learning, for the skill development. And that's a very important part of what we do. The learning and the education is key, but it's got to be fun and engaging.
So Heather Norton, talk to me a little bit about some of the partnerships you're involved in. There's code.org, there's an engineering program. What's going on with what the Science Center is doing there?
Sure. So one of the things the Science Center has started to do strategically is look at ways we can leverage our national relationships to bring high-quality content and programming to Central Florida. So code.org is a national group. It's a nonprofit that was focused around bringing computer science for all children. And so we are a regional hub for code.org, and what they're trying to do is set up these regional hubs across all 50 states that allow us to support teachers around computer science, offer computer science for families and for children, and really start to make computational thinking a part of our everyday education system.
Is there a way to build in the kind of hands-on learning you have here, or is it a matter of parking a kid in front of a computer and saying, go code something?
I love that you just phrased it that way. One of the really exciting things for us about code.org is it's more than just being in front of a device and about the technology itself. They do what they call plugged and unplugged activities, so it really takes computational thinking into the real world and has some of the activities happen with paper or with real materials, and it's talking about the strategies or the concepts in computer science, but how that can be done in a hands-on way, which is so great for us because that's who we are. There certainly is time in front of the computer or the machine where you're actually starting to do some coding and programming, but it's that fusion or that combination of the hands-on and the technical that I think makes it so strong.
Do you think is there a technological barrier, say, if kids don't have access to a computer at home, that sort of technology, is that something that a science center can bridge or a gap that they can bridge?
So there is certainly disparity in computer science, which is why I think we're looking at embedding it into the K-12 education system. I don't think it's so much about the device anymore as it's about how that learning takes place using the technology, because I think without that understanding, we're missing a key component of offering our children success in future careers and jobs. I think every profession is going to need some level of computer science understanding just to be competitive. And so I think it's really about looking at how you take computational thinking beyond just using a computer or a tablet or a smartphone and seeing how that technology or how those processes apply to our daily life.
Joanne, let me pick up on that then. I mean, over the last 12 months, more than that, in fact, politically, there's been a lot of talk about the kind of careers that are on offer in the United States, focus on manufacturing. I'm wondering what your thoughts are as far as sort of jobs of the future for the United States and how STEM education fits into that big picture.
Well, I think what's happening, our jobs are changing as technology is introduced, as there's more and more automation by, you know, even in terms of the energy field, right? I think the focus is going to be on, there are a lot of careers that we don't even know what they are yet. And that's why when we talk about STEM and technology, it's hard to predict where it's going. So you have to be able to have the skills. You have to be able to solve problems. That's one of the most critical things that we feel we're missing. And we, as a science center, want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to expose our youth to that. So, you know, we're not going to give kids a multiple choice test in the science center. What we're focusing on is create something. How would you design that? How would you build it? Test it out. Oh, it broke. It fell apart. What happened? How do we go back and fix it? We're celebrating our failures in those cases. But it's all about saying, how do I solve this problem? Give them an incentive to solve the problem. And the creative thinking can be truly amazing, even from our littlest children.
Joanne Newman is the president of the Orlando Science Center. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Matthew. It's been a pleasure.
And Heather Norton is the Vice President of Education. Thank you so much, Heather.
Thank you, Matthew. It's a pleasure.
Up next, behind the scenes with the Orlando Ballet as they fine-tune their annual holiday performance of The Nutcracker. Intersection returns in a minute. This is Intersection, and I'm Matthew Petty. With Tchaikovsky blasting through the stereo, dancers with the Orlando Ballet are rehearsing The Nutcracker. They pirouette across the floor at their practice venue, the Lockhaven Neighbourhood Centre. The music stops and artistic director Robert Hill jumps up from the sideline to coach the dancers.
And off, go, there, that's right. Put her down carefully.
The Nutcracker is a holiday classic, and Hill says you'll hear the music from the ballet everywhere, in shopping malls, elevators, the grocery store.
It's an annual favorite all over the world. For some reason, it's become this thing that people like to go to see during the holidays. Clara receives a gift of this Nutcracker Prince, and she dreams at night. The prince battles the Rat King, and then she's transported to the land of the sweets, and she gets to meet the Sugar Plum Fairy and her cavalier. And then the dream comes to an end, and she's left wondering, did I actually experience that, or was it just a dream? And it's just has a appeal for all family members of all ages.
So people were probably familiar with the music. What about the choreography, though? How difficult is it for the dancers?
There's so many different versions out there. The classical pas de deux for the Sugar Plum Fairy and the Cavalier is a lot of times it's considered a traditional from petit pas. So a lot of people use that. And then the rest of the divertissement, a lot of the other dancing, typically choreographers or artistic directors will do their own version of it. So I've made it very challenging dancing because I think it needs to be exciting for the audience to see the dancers pull off these amazing feats. So the people coming to see this production will get some very strong dancing.
Now, when you watch the dancers in rehearsal, it's it's clear just how tough it is and how athletic it is. I mean, this is a workout, but you probably don't want that to come across on stage, do you? You want to get them to keep their poise while they're pulling off these pretty difficult feats of choreography.
That's the dichotomy, is to make it look like it's effortless when it's absolutely not effortless. And so it's like any athlete who trains and trains and trains and trains to be able to pull off these things seemingly effortlessly, you know. And in ballet, definitely, the art form is to present something that is not just athletic, but...
Okay, so how are your dancers enjoying this? Is this something they look forward to every year? Because you guys present it every year, right?
Yes, we do. I think the majority of the dancers enjoy doing it every year. You know, when I was getting toward the end of my career, close to the age of 40, I got a little bit tired of doing Nutcracker, I have to say. You know, because during the season, not only are you hearing it in the studio rehearsing it, but you hear it at the grocery store, you hear it at the department store, you hear it in elevators, and so it's a little bit overkill with the music sometimes. Even though it's beautiful music, you know.
So if you're looking to keep it fresh, both for the audience and for the dancers, and you don't want to mess with the choreography too much, as far as the set design, that kind of thing, are there other things you can do to keep the story original and new for audiences?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my big hope is to eventually, in the next couple of years, to do a really brand new, super-duper production. And I want, you know, flying elements, and I want, you know, all of that kind of thing. You know, sort of Broadway show kind of quality production. So it's all just a matter of money, really, you know. So, I mean, the dancing, the structure, the flow of the story, the flow of the score is what it is. And, you know, you can play with that to a certain extent, but not really, you know. I mean, it is what it is. And, you know, sometimes people take it, the story, and they'll set it in 1950s America, or, you know, all different ways of doing it. So we're keeping it pretty much at this point traditional, what would be considered a traditional Nutcracker. So,
now, is this sometimes the first time anybody will see a live ballet, the Nutcracker?
I have a feeling probably yes. I think it's very accessible. I think even if you do very specific tweaks of the storyline, people generally understand what they're watching. And I think that that's one of the things that people are afraid of with regard to ballets. They're not going to understand it, you know? It's not the case with Nutcracker. Nutcracker people have to understand. And the other really great element that we have in our production is the snow scene at the end of Act One, where the ballerinas and all the snowflakes are dancing as the snow's coming down. It's quite beautiful. I'm quite proud of it.
Because you've got to tell a story without using words, which is difficult.
Exactly, exactly. So there are elements of mime, and again, these mime gestures have to be, you know, finessed and coached clearly so that the audience knows what they're looking at, you know. So, but yeah, it's all about telling the story without using words.
Robert Hill, tell me about the cast you're working with now. Your dancers, some of them are fairly young, right?
Yeah, the age of the company is pretty young. I would say the actual company members are between the ages of 18 and 34-ish kind of thing. And then we've got all the school kids. I mean, over the course of the six performances that we're going to be doing, there's going to be over 190 kids from our school in the production. So that's another big element to juggle. But yeah, it's big cast.
And is that something you do every year, bring the kids into the production?
Absolutely. George Balanchine, who, you know, is famous for New York City Ballet and his Nutcracker production, said that having kids in the performance guarantees that you'll get four audience members per kid: mom, dad, sister, and auntie. So he says you put enough kids in the cast, you've got your audience. And it's part of the appeal for the kids coming to our school, is they know that they get to dance in the Nutcracker, or they get the opportunity to audition to be in the Nutcracker. And it's a big deal, especially for the Claras, the little girl who tells the story. It's such a big deal for those little girls to be accepted as Clara for the production of Nutcracker.
I imagine there's a bit of competition for that role then.
Oh, yes, I think that there is. And there's, yeah, it's a big deal. So
So tell me about the school. Is it, like, how long do they have to be dancing in it to be able to perform in this ballet?
In Nutcracker, we have many, many opportunities. Some of the other ballets, we don't, but it depends. For the children of the parents in Act One, they're typically the younger kids in the school. Some of the more advanced students get to actually dance in some of the second act variations and divertissement. There's opportunities for all different levels in the school. It's exciting, yeah. We're going to be performing this at the Disney Theater and the Dr. Phillips Center. It's a terrific venue. It's beautiful. And what I like to say about it is, not that I have anything against the Bob Carr, certainly, but you really can't compare the two spaces. But, you know, it's like any painting or any work of art, you know, if it's how you frame it. So the ballet is framed in that beautiful theater, in that beautiful center, you know, so it really enhances the quality of our product.
And the ballet has a new executive director, right?
Yes, Caroline Miller. She's very new, and she's also from London, so she has to get used to being in Orlando. She has to get used to being in the United States and working in a nonprofit organization, which is a different structure than what she was used to in the UK. But she's very fast, and she's very smart, and she's accomplishing a lot. But there's a lot to accomplish, so giving her the time and space to do what she's doing, and she's great.
Is the ballet in good shape at the moment? You obviously, with the old rehearsal venue, there were some issues, health issues there, but this is a pretty great space for you guys. Overall, how are things going for the ballet?
Oh, overall, very, very good, actually. I mean, the fact that we had Michael Kaiser here to help turn the organization around, so financially we're much healthier than we were. You were referring to healthy in terms of being the building we were kicked out of was because of mold infestation. So it's much healthier for us to be in this building, the Lock Haven Neighborhood Center. Overall, I think that the organization is in a much better place than it was a year ago, 2 years ago.
And it kind of fits into the bigger picture of the arts in Orlando, right? Like the ballet is a pretty important part of that culture that's going on here in the city. Beautiful.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's really terrific. Our mayor is Buddy Dyer is a huge supporter of the arts, and he's been doing a lot, as you know. He wasn't able to come to our most recent production of Dracula, but he asked to come to the dress rehearsal because he didn't want to miss it, which I thought was really terrific to have that kind of support, you know. And he proudly says all over town how happy he is and proud he is that we have a world-class ballet company in Orlando. So it's very nice to have that endorsement.
And you can focus more on what your job is, which is, you know, artistic creative director, rather than having to worry about some of the other things?
Yes. I've been waiting to have an executive director for a long time. And I do have a lot of creative ideas that get clouded over with, you know, the challenges that we've been facing over the 8 years that I've been here, if you can believe. It'll be nice to be able to just sort of let other people do their jobs.
Now, you talked about what you'd like to see as far as a more souped-up version of the Nutcracker down the track, once you have the resources to do so. What other ideas do you want to put in place once you can focus on that and have a little bit more resources to do that?
I've had on my list of ballets that I want to create a new Peter Pan. And I think with a lot of the new technology that's available in theaters in terms of projections and also flying elements, can be very, very exciting. And I also want that to be a brand new score by an American composer named Lowell Lieberman. So it'll be new from top to bottom, except it will tell the Peter Pan story. So.
Okay, now tell me about Lowell Lieberman.
Interesting guy. When I did one of my first choreographies for American Ballet Theater in New York City, where I danced most of my career, a friend of mine said, "My gosh, you've got to listen to this piece of music." And so I did, and it turns out this guy named Lowell Lieberman. And so I wanted to do some research about who he is. And anyway, long story short, I talked to some of my musician friends in New York City, and he lived one block away from me on the Upper West Side in Manhattan. So I had somebody introduce us, and we've become great friends. I've choreographed several of his pieces, and he too is dying to do this Peter Pan, because he is kind of a Peter Pan kind of guy, you know. So terrific composer, beautiful music, and very theatrical kind of guy, you know.
What's the music like? I'm guessing it's probably not like Tchaikovsky, which is what you're performing at the moment.
No, but I think that some of the largeness of the Tchaikovsky music will be a similar thing. I don't know if you had a chance to come and see our Beauty and the Beast that we did last year, our Wunderkind, Arcadian Broad, who you were just watching rehearse with Kate, the Grand Pas de Deux from Nutcracker. He is also a composer. So he composed his own music for his ballet, Beauty and the Beast, that was played live by the Central Florida Community Arts Orchestra and presented at the Dr. Phillips Center last season. And he's working on a new one that we're going to be doing down the road, telling the Alice in Wonderland story through the eyes of the Mad Hatter.
Wow, it sounds like he's got his hands full.
He's got his hands full, and his brain is pretty phenomenal. He's a super talent. So I've also, if I can't get Lowell, or if Lowell doesn't have the time in his schedule, then I would definitely have Arcadian compose the music and co-choreograph Peter Pan with me. So it's very exciting.
So this is the last set of performances you're doing for this year. What's the year been like?
Actually, our season goes from October to May. So we opened with Dracula the end of October, the 3 days leading up to Halloween, so that timing was great. And then we do Nutcracker. And then in February, we're going to do a one-night-only tribute to Harriet Lake. So what that means is Harriet gave me a list of her favorite Broadway songs from her favorite Broadway shows, and we put them together to do a suite of her favorite things from Broadway. It's going to be a fabulous show. And we're doing a big dinner in the DeVos family room upstairs. Almost all of the tables are sold pretty much already. So that's going to be in February. In March, we're doing a master's program, which I'm very excited about. It's going to be George Balanchine's Serenade to music of Tchaikovsky, Jerome Robbins' Fancy Free with music of Bernstein, Leonard Bernstein, and it's a precursor to on the Town with the sailors in New York City and everything. So it was a real crowd pleaser. And then the third element of that program is going to be by Twyla Tharp. She created on Mikhail Baryshnikov and Elaine Kudo something called Sinatra Suite. So it's all songs sung by Frank Sinatra. Terrific, terrific. Another crowd pleaser. So that's going to be a wonderful program in March. And then we're going to close the season end of April with something called A Cinderella Story, which is not going to be to the Prokofiev, the well-known Prokofiev music. It's actually a friend of mine named Val Cannaparoli found this Rodgers and Hammerstein music that he decided he wanted to tell sort of an updated version of Cinderella. So he calls it A Cinderella Story. And it's, I think, based in the set in the 50s. And it's going to be a real fun take and very accessible kind of music and everything. So that's how the season looks for this year.
Do you guys get to take a break over the Christmas? Or
we're actually doing Nutcracker earlier in December this year, 1 week earlier. So we'll be finished by December 11th. With Nutcracker. And then we're going to rehearse for 3 more days the following week. And then we have 2 weeks off for the Christmas holidays, which I look forward to, actually. We had Thanksgiving week off. So after we come back, starting January 3rd, it's going to be pretty much a straight run to the end of the season.
Well, Robert Hill, thank you so much.
Thank you, Matthew. It's an honor to speak with you.
Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from Florida Hospital. Intersection's producer is Brandon Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Our intern is Talia Blake. Find this and previous episodes at our website, wmfe.org, or wherever you download your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.